KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
There are 50-plus Canadian passport holders who have either left the country or who have attempted to leave the country to engage in some form of violent jihad.
I am not Honey Boo Boo Child. No, I'm sorry. That's just not me. It never was, and it never will be. But please don't cry, because my reality show is so boring.
I'd rather you didn't touch on the 787, because this is really a flash in the pan. So I'd prefer to say that we're confident in the aircraft. We're confident in the delivery schedule. We're confident in the process that is being followed.
A look at Boeing and the Dreamliner this hour on Weekday. Also a conversation about privacy and public people. But we start by taking a look at Canada and the reports that Canadian citizens are part of the terror circuit in North Africa. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. He joins us on Weekday. Good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you.
Canada and Mali, Algeria, a connection that, you know, I was watching a rerun of NCIS yesterday, and sometimes I watch that show and I think, oh, how preposterous. Here's this American-looking guy walking the streets of Washington, D.C., and he turns out to be a jihadist. And then, whoops.
This is a very sensitive thing for Canada, this issue, right? So the after that horrific hostage-taking in Algeria, the Prime Minister of Algeria accused Canada, said the mastermind, one of the masterminds of this thing, was a Canadian. And there have also been news reports that the person who was handling media relations on this issue was also a Canadian. So the Canadian government, needless to say, is somewhat taken aback by this. The Canadian Security and Intelligence Service is in overdrive checking out the allegation, but the other news we've got is that our Foreign Affairs Minister, John Baird, has called on Algeria's ambassador to Canada to come forward with the evidence. Don't make an accusation like this without producing the evidence. You can figure out why, you know from us having done this for a while, Steve, why Canada is so sensitive on this. Canada and the United States, Canada is trying to work with the United States to create a common security cordon around North America to allow the free movement of people and goods and to share intelligence. If there's evidence out there that somebody with a Canadian passport was involved in an incident like this, that is going to undermine that cooperation and the chances for making that work.
Well, they have these quotes in the article that you sent and other articles from reporters who were there. One terrorist shouted, "Open the door," with a North American accent, and then fired. That's what one hostage told the AFP. The French news agency, two other Japanese hostages died, four other Japanese bodies found at the base. One of the kidnappers was tall, blonde, with blue or green eyes and spoke English. That was a Algerian military source told the Norwegian newspaper.
What yeah, and an allegation of a Canadian accent, which I guess means the famous A.
Yeah.
Maybe he was wearing a Vancouver Canucks T-shirt. Look, seriously, and I mean, we can make jokes about it, and obviously there's a bit of black humor here, but this is a really serious one. It's possible. You wouldn't deny it, that it's not. You wouldn't say it's not possible. We've certainly had evidence in the past of people with terrorist connections in Canada. One possible route is Canada has had a certain amount of immigration from people from former French colonies in Africa because the province of Quebec, being French, has control over its own immigration, and it has welcomed and encouraged immigration from French-speaking countries around the world. We have a lot of people from Haiti here. We have a lot of North Africans who have come from countries that were former French colonies. So that's where the connection comes from. But as I said, the Canadian government is admitting nothing at the moment, although, as I said, we're told, Steve, that our own security and intelligence service is in overdrive trying to check this out. The Canadian government is demanding the evidence, and needless to say, they're going to want to see proof before they agree this person is a Canadian either person is a Canadian. And it's possible, of course, as well, that you could be traveling on forged passports, that they may not be Canadians. They may be people who have Canadian passports.
Now, while this is unfolding, Canada is involved in the military effort in Mali.
Yes. Canada has provided, has responded to a request from the French government for assistance in moving troops and material to Mali. So the French are going in with a military presence, and Canada has loaned a military transport plane, a C-17, to ferry troops into Mali. French troops and also perhaps a couple of former French colonies, I think, have offered troops for this effort as well. So that's what Canada's involvement is. Our Prime Minister is out today, quoted this morning, saying that the Canadian government is looking for consensus within the country and with the other political parties in Parliament over whether or not we should become more involved. The Canadian government has at the moment said, we're landing a military transport plane, we're not going to get more involved than that, but we'd like to hear from Canadians and from the other parties whether you know, something between full-blown military involvement and more assistance to the French would be acceptable.
Well, you have the Globe and Mail headline, Is Canada at War in Mali? I mean, and the other headline, despite fears of mission creep, Canada to deepen role in Mali. How will he be testing, Mr. Harper, Canadian opinion?
Well, I think the first thing he's going to look to see what the other parties in Canada have to say. There's other political parties in Canadian Parliament, and in the past, they have been supportive of some involvement for Canada in some of these kind of actions. If there's going to be a real rift around any involvement, I think Harper would be reluctant to go any further. But France is an ally, and they've been asking for assistance, and so far we have loaned some assistance, although, granted, one military transport plane is not a lot. You raised the other issue, Steve, and I think it's an obvious one to anybody, that as we saw with Algeria, involvement in this action could make a country a target for terrorism as well.
You know, Vaughn, over the 27 years you've been doing this, or in the 27 years, 6 years I've been doing this, we see in this discussion the large historical forces, if I may. I sound like I'm lecturing. You know, from a bipolar world to the fall of, we see this multipolar world, and here is Canada embroiled across the world in foreign affairs, which I don't think we would have thought Canada would be dealing with 20 years ago.
Well, and you and I started doing this. I started doing KUOW in 1987, in early January, so the wall had not come down. It was still a Cold War world and a bipolar one. Brian Mulroney was Prime Minister of Canada, and Ronald Reagan, gone by 1987.
No, he was still with
president.
Us.
And we had Canada and the United States that had some rocky relations around Reagan. But Mulroney and Reagan were on tremendous, tremendous friends. And to the point, in fact, where, as you'll recall, Mulroney was asked to give one of the eulogies at Reagan's funeral.
Yeah.
So that was the world, and things have changed an awful lot since then. I'm always, you know, and you're right, events unfolded in ways that none of us imagined when the wall came down. That was the end of the world's troubles, supposedly.
Yeah.
Here we are today, right?
Well, and here's Canada, one of the major oil producers in the world, and the United States having some questions about how that oil is produced, and now with President Obama talking about climate change in the second inaugural, some questions about what's going to happen with that pipeline.
The news coverage on this in Canada in the last 48 hours has been phenomenal. It's like a roller coaster. The president comes out on Monday, Steve, and he says that the United States is going to be a world leader in climate change, and the Canadian media fill up with stories that that's bad news for our attempt to build a Keystone pipeline to the United States. It's a sign that Obama is not very sympathetic to Canada shipping more oil to the U.S., particularly from the Alberta oil sands, or tar sands, if you want to call them that. And this is bad news. And then the governor of Nebraska comes along and signs off on the pipeline through his state. Nebraska was the big holdout. There was a whole issue over the sand hills. The Canadian company that wanted to build a pipeline relocated the route. And the governor has signed off essentially throwing the challenge back to the president. So today, Canadian media, Steve, are full of stories. Oh, this is good news for the pipeline. So the pipeline's gone from bad news to good news in the space of a 48-hour news cycle.
I wonder if that's where President Obama will fight this battle, in the pipeline, considering how he had sort of punted on it earlier.
Yeah, I would bet that he was sort of hoping that it wouldn't come this quickly. I mean, there are other reasons why the pipeline might be turned down. I think also the big change here in Canada since we first started talking about this, Steve, I think is an awareness in Canada that, you know, the pipeline through British Columbia was in trouble. That may not go ahead, probably won't go ahead. Keystone is still up in the air and in doubt. There's a lot more talk in Canada here about, I guess you'd call it Plan C, if Keystone was Plan A and a pipeline through BC was Plan B. A talk about Plan C, sending the oil to eastern Canada to be refined in eastern Canada and shipped into the world market for oil as essentially a refined Canadian product. This oil is going to find an outlet, in my view, until the world weans itself off reliance on fossil fuels. It will be one of the products that's available. And stopping one particular pipeline is not going to stop the use of this oil, as I say, until the whole world together reduces its reliance on burning the stuff.
You know, Vaughn, I noticed that just as a follow-up, I noticed that the First Nations leaders just today, I guess it just came out, actually, the First Nations leaders signed a declaration of commitment. They're going to end the hunger strike that Chief Theresa Spence has been involved in that we've been talking about.
Yeah, this woman who is, I mean, it's a gripping and a sad story, who's been involved in this protest for some time now. She's on a liquid diet and obviously putting her health at risk and seeking better treatment for Canada's native peoples. One of the big exercises that's going on here is kind of to find a face-saving way to get her out of that, because I think a lot of even native leaders have realized that she made a point. She got public attention, and by continuing on this course, really all she's doing is putting her own health at risk. But it's been very difficult. Prime Minister met with Native leaders 10 days ago. Now it looked like that might be the breakthrough. But still, as you say, there's the story out this morning. They're now trying to push her. Her own people are trying to push her into ending this thing. And I guess she's so, you know, bound up in it. She's made such a personal sacrifice of her own health and put herself at risk that she doesn't think that she's gotten enough yet to allow her to make a face-saving retreat.
All right. Well, that's good. Now, what about Prime Minister Harper taking everybody to see Lincoln?
Well, according to a column by Jeffrey Simpson, who's the country's leading political columnist in the Globe and Mail, before Christmas, the Prime Minister took a bunch of his members of his conservative caucus, so his elected members of parliament, off to see Lincoln, and then led a discussion on the film afterwards. So a nice little seminar, and I don't think it was a discussion about what a great director Steven Spielberg is, or what a great actor Daniel Day-Lewis is, or how Tommy Lee Jones damn near stole the show. The feeling is, Simpson suggests, that it was a discussion about two elements in the film that are there. One is the need for compromise in politics, and another about the need for people to stick together if they're going to continue to govern.
Well, we'll see how that works out for them in the years ahead.
I mean, have you seen the movie? I mean, I just think
it's
not a remarkable film.
I want to see it. Sounds great.
It's to make a really exciting, thrilling, gripping story out of getting a piece of legislation through the House of Representatives. Spielberg's a genius.
All right, Vaughn. On that note, I will talk to you next week.
Okay, next week it is.
Thank you for talking to us. Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun.
Speaking of film, when it comes to appreciating a work of art, how much do you concern yourself with the artist's private life? Can you, should you, separate the two? Some thoughts on that in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Terry Green Sterling has a lot of experience as a reporter in rural Arizona. She keeps a Colt 45 in the glove box.
I have felt, on occasion, driving late at night, it's nice that I have the gun. It's just a little extra bit of comfort.
Coming up on the next edition of The Story, our chance to hear your stories about guns.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. Find it online at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, providing water filters for the kitchen and bath with home and office installation and service since 1981, located in Shoreline and online at CustomPure.com.
43 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to get some rain today. It's 10:20. How might the problems with Boeing's Dreamliner affect Washington's unemployment situation? We'll take that up in 20 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
We're heading out to the lobby to talk about movies with Robert Horton. I'm playing less because I got some complaints, Robert Horton, about how long I let the theme go.
Yeah.
I just like that theme.
It's
like
a good theme.
I like imagining the dancing snowcap candies and the dancing giant cup of Pepsi.
Popcorn with buttery flavor.
Spilling out.
Yeah.
You were thinking about what we know about artists and how that affects our appreciation of their work.
Yes, I was. A couple of things happened to make me think of this subject, which has always been kind of an intriguing subject to me. And one of the things that happened was seeing Jodie Foster's speech at the Golden Globe Awards. It was a career appreciation speech, but one of the main things that came out of it was her, Jodie Foster, saying something about the idea of privacy and of what you need to know about someone. And so she's kind of mocked this idea that if a Hollywood star has something to say about his or her private life, they have to call a press conference and, you know, bring everybody in to announce this and sell the rights to the photos of their babies and so on. And she did it in one way by making fun of her own unannounced sexual orientation, which has been widely talked about without quite being talked about for many years. And she came, and it was very funny. She came up to the point of saying, you know, I'm, and then she said, single.
Is she single now?
She's single now.
She's not with that woman she had been with for many years?
Not anymore, apparently, though she alluded to her with great affection during this speech. And she was Jodie Foster was, you know, tweaking this idea that you should even know that, or that she is obliged somehow to tell you that and to announce to you all of these facets of her personal life.
I guess I just have a sudden urge to say something that I've never really been able to air in public. So a declaration that I'm a little nervous about, but maybe not quite as nervous as my publicist right now, huh, Jennifer? You know, I'm just going to put it out there, right? Loud and proud, right? So I'm going to need your support on this. I am single. Yes, I am. I am single. No, I'm kidding. But I mean, I'm not really kidding, but I'm kind of kidding. I mean, thank you for the enthusiasm. Can I get a wolf whistle or something? Please. Jesus. Seriously. I hope that you're not disappointed that there won't be a big coming out speech tonight, because I already did my coming out about 1,000 years ago, back in the Stone Age, in those very quaint days when a fragile young girl would open up to trusted friends and family, coworkers, and then gradually, proudly to everyone who knew her, to everyone she actually met. But now, apparently, I'm told that every celebrity is expected to honor the details of their private life with a press conference, a fragrance, and a primetime reality show.
And the very fact of her not saying things seems to upset a lot of people.
I remember interviewing her, High Point, movie star, Hollywood star, big shot, and debating whether that was a question to ask her.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I decided no, because it wasn't about the movie she was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't really about her career. I don't know if that was right or wrong, but I understand her concerns.
Well, that kind of question is, I guess, what she was addressing is, and what we're addressing here is it about her career? What does that have to do with her career?
Only Some, if, Only if she's only if it's part of the movie or part of a character she's playing, perhaps.
That's true, although you could also make the argument, what difference would that make? Why wouldn't...
actors are actors. They're acting.
Yeah, a straight white male be able to make an interesting movie about gay black females? You know, plug in whatever you want.
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa, of course. Yeah. And so I really was
taken...
Well,
as a journalist, do you avoid those sorts of... I mean, do you consciously say, you know, I'm not going to ask this actor about that because I don't care if they drive a Ferrari and have a hot tub.
Well, I've... or drive a Ferrari in a hot tub, which would be a good question, actually. I've met Jodie Foster, too, and I didn't ask her anything like that. And I have no... I'm not interested. Yeah. Well, but then I've had, you know, limited success in my career.
Well, it's a different level of media, isn't it?
It certainly is.
I mean, boy, if she was on... 60 Minutes or TMZ, that would probably be something they would feel obliged or pressured to ask.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting that they would, yes, someone would be pressuring them to ask that. Somebody from in an office somewhere.
And who would think you weren't meeting your duty as a journalist if you did not ask Jodie Foster if she was really gay.
Yeah, or whatever their motivation was.
Yeah.
But I sure liked her saying that in a kind of a witty way. In a way that apparently did not connect with a lot of people who are watching the show, and you had the examples of her appearing at this show with apparently her two best friends, Robert Downey Jr. and Mel Gibson, who have had their share of off-screen adventures and tabloid sorts of things, which that just sort of heightened what she was saying—the fact that she apparently is close to these people who have been so burned. Not that they haven't lit the matches themselves at times, but certainly burned by that tabloid culture.
Okay, interesting question, though. Speaking of directors rather than actors for a minute, Polanski. Is my enjoyment of Polanski, it's definitely affected by my knowledge that of the conviction that he was given and his escape to Europe and his inability to work in America because of a statutory rape charge.
Yeah.
It affects my enjoyment of his work. Does it affect his work? That's two different questions. Should be, right?
I'm not sure if they're two different questions. I guess they are two different questions. But, you know, that is that leads me to the other thing that I encountered. So I'll mention that now, and we'll talk about your question. And the other thing I encountered is a film that is opening on Friday at the Grand Illusion Theater. It's called Wagner and Me. And it is the British comedian Stephen Fry, noted wit, very interesting fellow, comedian, actor, writer, leading us on his own personal journey with his lifelong passion for the music of Wagner. Not just the music, but also the dramaturgy, I guess, or the writing and the big vision of Wagner. He's besotted with Wagner. He's his favorite artist. He makes the case that Wagner may be the greatest artist. Of the last 200 years anyway.
Really?
And of course, he deals in this documentary with those uncomfortable things that come up when you're talking about Wagner. And
how music can go on a little too long. And
well, not just duration, yes. That is one thing that comes up. And those hard seats at the Bayreuth Theater. But Fry, for one thing, Fry has Jewish parentage, and so he brings up... Wagner's virulent, some of the very virulent anti-Semitic things that Wagner actually committed to paper, and also the fact that the Nazis just loved Wagner's music, embraced it, extolled it, developed a relationship with maintaining the Wagner tradition.
I am deeply uncomfortable in Nuremberg talking about Wagner. I realize how close to the Nazi fantasy world Wagner was.
One's experience of Wagner can't help but be tainted by that knowledge, but it connects with this question of then this is what Stephen Fry is looking at. He's saying, I still love this music. I mean, his music is so incredible, and so how do I reconcile with what I know about the artist with my own very deeply personal relationship to the art?
You know, Stephen Fry is also out as a gay man.
He is.
I don't remember how Wagner was with the gays, but there's, I'm sure, complexity there as well. How does he answer that? in the end in this movie.
Well, he's reconciled it within himself, and he's because he knows he's obviously thought about it a lot, and he knows about his feelings with the music. I'm not sure he's examined every aspect of it exactly, but he does sit down at one point with for quite an interesting moment with a woman who, when she was a child, was in an extermination camp, and she had the ability to play the cello. And I'm sure that you've heard about these people who had a particular talent who survived because they played for other, some of their fellow, I'm hesitating, I don't know what's the word, inmate, is that the right word?
Prisoners,
as well as playing for, you know, the guards and the Nazis. And so she, of course, has a slightly more jaundiced view of Wagner and she's interesting to watch and to how she talks about it. And she kind of goads him into looking at things. But it's the question that he raises is just really interesting because I tend to put aside something dire that I know about a person's personal life, an artist's personal life, because what they have created is something that is unto itself and that exists. I don't for a second not fault Polanski for his decision making on the day that he was jailed for. And yet, you know, we watch his films and he is unquestionably this fantastic artist and incredibly gifted. And his movies, many of them stand as, as these rich objects.
Critic and commentator Robert Horton's our guest. You know, it goes way beyond art or even film. Ty Cobb, people think about Ty Cobb, the baseball player, and have to deal with his...
Yeah,
virulent racism.
Yeah, horrible person.
And the treatment of just about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Or even here in town, you go to Fremont, you look at that Lenin statue. That statue's there because the artist, who was involved in making it or part of the process by which those statues were made, wanted it to be seen for its place in history, but also for its art. And yet, other people look at that and just are aghast because to them, Lenin is Stalin and communism and mm-hmm. millions of people who died.
Yeah. And in that case, isn't it also they're trying to reappropriate it as kitsch and turn it on its head in a sense?
I think that's what I've always kind of, that too.
Which is a kind of a delicate balance, and you kind of rely on your audience to understand
get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If there was something, there has to be a test, and this is what everybody has to do. If there's something, for instance, that you if you experience Wagner and, you're watching The Ring and I don't know, if you experience some dishonesty in what's coming out of that. I don't experience any dishonesty in Polanski's films, for instance. I find them really...
How do you mean by dishonesty? In the presentation of, the heroic presentation of Wagner?
Well, let's, as an example, Ella, if you find that to be serving... some kind of ideal that really is propagating prejudice and ignorance and elevation of some weird racial ideal, for instance. But I'm not an expert in The Ring, so I should hesitate before being definitive on that. But I think it's possible to experience those things without seeing that stated by the artist, but to see how somebody with a warped imagination and their ideological agenda can take Wagner and just absolutely run with it because it's in there waiting to be exploited.
Boy, there's a lot of stuff in these ideas that are profound. I mean, because we could take it back down to, do I enjoy Woody Allen movies more or less, knowing that Woody Allen married his daughter. I know she was adopted and all that,
yes.
But still his daughter.
Oh, I'm sure we both know people who boycott Woody Allen movies. I do.
Or Jerry Lee Lewis because he married somebody who was underage.
Yes.
Though with consent. And
yeah. Yeah.
The second cousin, I forget.
Well, something like that. I'm not sure how close. But
Or Mel Gibson. Talk about Mel Gibson, knowing his rants and
yeah.
And how he was arrested. Does that affect me enjoying Mel Gibson movies. Now, I thought some recent Mel Gibson movies have sort of played with that reality of how he's being perceived. Or maybe it's just Mel Gibson because he's always coming across in his later, these more recent films as a victim, somebody who's fighting back against a sort of a victimhood that's been put on him.
Well, I think he's tapped that probably for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you know, it's funny because I don't know if you take a film like Gibson's film, Passion of the Christ, and if you think that has somehow done actual damage in the world, along with apparently capturing the imagination of a lot of people, or can you look at it and say, wow, this is a really sort of fraught, imagined version of the Passion by someone who seems to be wrestling with some pretty serious demons? And I think you could say that seeing that movie without knowing that Mel
Yes.
Gibson was an actor who, you know, has some problems and is clearly been caught on tape wrestling, struggling with those demons.
Yeah.
So we actually have evidence of it because that movie is very fraught and strange and kind of neurotic in a way.
Do we need to know, I guess this is maybe an unanswerable or obvious question, do we need to know the background of the artist in order to appreciate their work? I mean, I know there are whole disciplines
yes,
that study
are.
That question.
Right, right. That's a big thing right now. I will be honest and say that I tend to go toward the side that thinks that I'm on Jodie Foster's side. I think we don't need to know so much, and the work will be there, you know, 1,000 years from now, maybe, if they figured out this whole digital storage thing with movies and we won't necessarily recall what was going on with the makers, but we will have the thing itself that we will then have to deal with. And dealing with it might be problematic and might give us difficulties, but that's supposed to be part of the richness of it.
I realize I'm going highbrow and lowbrow in these examples, but sometimes I watch the TV show How I Met Your Mother, and the character of Barney Stinson is this oversexed male. And of course, the actor who's playing that role is gay and has come out as gay and talks about being gay. And they play with that knowledge, I think, in the show to let him be less offensive as a character.
Mm.
I wonder if that's true or not.
Because
that's how I feel.
You think that they're in on they think the audience is in on the joke already. Everybody knows Neil Patrick Harris is out. Here
yes.
he is as a heterosexual.
Of the worst kind.
Male, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wonder.
And that's part of the energy of the
yeah.
comic energy of that character.
Yeah. And there we're back to TMZ land, of course, but they're playing with that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true, but that's how it feels to me sometimes in the writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even as I'm coming out in favor of privacy, I also certainly acknowledge that a lot of what we experience in popular culture is completely overlapping with what we know of the off-screen realities of artists and actors and filmmakers and so on, and that sometimes that can be used in a way that is could be delightful, you know.
How come Jodie Foster wasn't Honey Boo Boo?
I didn't get that part. I don't know. That was an enigmatic allusion to me.
To somebody who gets dressed up and paraded out.
The other end of the spectrum of publicity.
So we should see this Stephen Fry movie at the Grand Illusion.
Wagner and Me. Yeah, I think it stirs up some things. Plus, you get to go into some great opera houses in Europe with Stephen Fry, which is not bad company.
Robert Horton reviews films for us, for the Herald and Everett, writes at thecropduster.com, does work with the Fry Art Museum for his Magic Lantern series.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
I am not Honey Boo Boo Child. No, I'm sorry. That's just not me. It never was, and it never will be. But please don't cry, because my reality show would be so boring.
#10:38. How might Boeing's woes affect Washington State's unemployment numbers? We'll take that up in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
How do you turn earthquake wreckage into art?
It's like a giant array of rusted steel rebar poles.
In this kind of undulating shape.
Almost as if it's an earthquake, as if the quake is waving through the gallery floors.
A new work from Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Over the years, membership contributions have brought great programming to you, our listeners. Creating a legacy gift to benefit KUOW builds a bridge from one generation of public radio listeners to the next. To learn more about how you can include KUOW in your estate plans, go to kuow.org/support-future.
44 degrees in Seattle with scattered light rain. Forecast says we're going to have some rain today, turning more towards showers this afternoon, and it's probably not going to get any warmer than it is right now. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:40. An update on Hillary Clinton's testimony regarding the attack last September on the embassy in Benghazi, Libya, is in our top of the hour newscast, which is just about 20 minutes away.
Did you mention it was raining right now?
I did.
Yeah. I can see out on our weather window that the folks in Red Square are now finally wet again.
The magic window.
The magic window of television. We can see that it is falling. So, yes. No umbrellas out yet, so it must not be that heavy. Michael Parks, you just came in from the rain. So
I had to turn on my windshield wipers for the first time in a long time.
Here we are. We're back. We're back at it now.
I can start a fire in my fireplace at Anderson Island, which I have been wanting to do.
Now, is that true? Oh, yeah, Anderson Island, you're probably good there.
Pierce County had the worst of the longest burn ban.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. More people burned wood in Pierce County, I think, than in King and Snohomish. So that's one reason.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Michael J. Parks is editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter, a resource about the economy. He's also a writer about business at MichaelJParks.com, and he joins us every few weeks to talk about the economy. Good to see you.
Glad to be here.
As you mentioned, the big story in this economy really is the continuing blues for the Dreamliner.
Absolutely.
It's worrying. It's worrying for
it is
this
worrying.
Economy, yes?
You know, John Talton, who sits in this seat every third week or so, he loves to append a haiku to his daily blog post. In his Sunday article on the Dreamliner, I thought he did an extraordinary job. No haiku, but his exit line was terse and to the point. I quote him because I can't say it better. Anxious weeks await. We don't know yet. We do know that the range of outcomes is very wide. We hope maybe the best case is a bad batch of batteries from Yuasa, a Japanese company that made these batteries, which are a key to the important electrical system on the plane. The lithium-ion material was chosen because it's very light. And, of course, Boeing wants a light airplane for the fuel efficiency, which is its main selling point. And we've had these airplanes out of the air for, what, going on 10 days?
Yeah.
And the longer it goes, the worse it gets. You know, we can hope, as I said, a batch of bad batteries, we get new batteries that don't have defects. The financial penalties are relatively light. They get worse if you have to bring in a new, heavier battery, especially if the new battery requires a redesign of the electrical system. A lot of money riding on this, and a lot of jobs.
That's the thing. I mean, the jobs that could be affected if 787 is grounded for longer, or if people start not having faith in the plane.
I started to say that John Talton wrote an excellent article. I couldn't think of anything else to say. One angle I don't think anybody's called attention to is that the grounding order and the inauguration of our new governor took place virtually within the same news cycle. I think both were on the front page in the newspaper. Think about Governor Gregoire. She had 3 years of what was called the Great Moderation in her first term before disaster struck in September of 2008 with the financial crisis. But here's Governor Inslee, a new governor who has promised no new tax increases, for example, even though maybe maintaining one that was about to expire. We won't call that a tax increase. But he potentially has an economic downturn or, worst case, an economic crisis on his hands right from the start.
You know, what effect do you think this has, this battery crisis and the risk. It's hard to imagine them writing off the whole program. One must assume, I know that's dangerous, sure, that the engineers are at work. They have contemplated enough scenarios that they'll have, I don't want to say workarounds, fixes
yes,
for this,
oh,
for these batteries.
Yeah.
But what does it do to the discussion between SPIA and Boeing right now?
Of course, it comes at a very awkward time. Boeing has made a final offer. SPIA has said, we reject your offer. We will ask our members, I think a week from tomorrow, whether they will authorize a strike, which I think would only be the second SPIA strike in the last 20 years or so. And, of course, management in Chicago, which outsourced much of this airplane, is counting on those engineers to find a fix and to rescue, to get the airplane back in the air, to normalize production, which is hugely important financially, because Boeing, it's going to take several years for Boeing to recover the development cost. In essence, these first few years, it's losing money on every plane that goes out, because it's each plane that goes out has to bear a part of the roughly $16 billion that Boeing put into development. Partners put in a roughly equal amount. And, of course, anybody who's been at Payne Field recently knows that Boeing has a lot of money tied up in inventory. And that inventory is not producing cash as long as these airplanes stay on the ground. So it needs to be fixed. Let's hope it is a battery problem. Let's hope it doesn't require redesign of the airplane. One other thing to say is that the trouble on the 787 in a perverse way have helped Washington's economy, because more people are working at Everett making good and fixing things and getting the early models problems solved. So I'm not sure. Of course, the absolute worst case is that the public loses confidence in Boeing. I don't think that's a possibility anytime soon. Think of how many 737s take off and land every minute, and they're almost part of the background. We don't even think about them anymore.
Well, what's so interesting about this story also is how, and a lot of people have written about this, Wall Street Journal had it yesterday, I think, batteries, that it's all hooked on the batteries, and the battery technology is not, it just hasn't kept pace with the demands we have for this technology.
It's not as mature.
Expands.
It's not as mature. In its early life, it had problems. We had laptops catching fire. The FAA reduced the number of lithium-ion batteries, being sent to manufacturers for putting in cell phones and laptops. They said you can't carry as many as you'd like in an airplane, plus precisely because even just sitting in inventory, they are risky. It raises the question, it's a fundamental question, is the technology mature enough to put in play the lives of 200 or 300 people who are flying on an airplane? And if the Dreamliner wins the certification that Boeing wants, will be flying up to 3 or 4 hours away from a alternate airport. A fire on an airplane is something you want never to happen.
Yeah.
Cannot accommodate that risk.
Yeah. Too hard to contemplate.
Yeah.
We had a weak employment report in the Evergreen State,
we
huh?
We did. About a week ago, the latest numbers from Washington's Employment Security Department for December, our unemployment rate ticked down a tenth of a percentage point to 7.6%. But the number of jobs, which has been mostly positive month by month, especially in the second half, declined by about 7,900, roughly split equally between public and private sectors. The surprise in the numbers was that retail employment declined by about 4,100 in December. Ordinarily, you'd expect an uptick. Doug Peterson, an economist who with another economist, Dick Conway, publishes the Puget Sound Economic Forecaster, said that this decline in retail may be a statistical quirk and may be adjusted away. But he also said it could reflect uncertainty on the part of businesses, especially in December, November, December. Remember the headlines. Every day you'd pick up the paper and read about the fiscal cliff, about the deficit debt problems, about taxes going up, and so forth. Steve, we have had other instances in 2012 where we had a red number on the preliminary report, and then that red number turns to black in the adjustment, and we may find that true. These numbers get adjusted three or four times, and we may find that the decline overall in December, about 8,000, and in retail, about 4,100, may go away. One reason the unemployment rate went down, however, is not good. It means partly that the workforce is growing smaller. A lot of young men are leaving Washington for jobs that are available in the oil business, in the oil exploration business, both in the United States and the Bakken Formation in North Dakota, for example, and also in the Canadian tar sands.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
They're not going as far as they would have had to go if they would have had to go to Arabia or Texas.
Sure.
They're going to North Dakota and Canada.
They live in man camps. If you read the New York Times, you know that the women who work in these vicinities are importuned much more than they would like to be for nefarious activities. It's a tough life. The food is good. The pay is good. The social conditions are not very good, unfortunately.
Man camps. Yeah. We're back in the 1890s.
Well, or the Alaska pipeline days in the mid to 1970s.
I guess so. Amazon. In the news again, Jeff Bezos is dazzling people.
You know, it seems like every time I was here last year, I was talking about some new wow factor about Amazon. And if you like irony, it's the National Retail Federation, which represents bricks and mortar stores. And they named Amazon the winner of their 2012 Gold Award. You know that it used to be you did your research online, and then you went to a bricks-and-mortar store and bought your product. And now, as the saying about Best Buy being Amazon's showroom, the situation has reversed. And so why would the National Retail Federation recognize Amazon? Well, somebody said they know that Bezos has what they all want, a thriving e-commerce business. A lot of respect on Wall Street. Remember, Amazon sells it sells everything at low margins and has a ridiculous price-earnings ratio and a cool factor when it comes to consumers. So.
It does have that ridiculous price-earnings ratio. It does have it's still having trouble making money, right?
Well, Bezos likes to say about potential businesses that he would get into that your margin is my opportunity. And we know from a story in the New York Times last August that they have this Amazon Web Services where essentially they take their IT infrastructure and open it up to anybody at constantly declining prices and on a utility basis where you pay only for what you use. And executives of that Amazon Web Services have said and were quoted in the New York Times as saying that the disruption that Amazon have accomplished so far in bookselling and other retailing will be a mere footnote when Amazon Web Services reaches its potential. The way I like to put it, I think Amazon still has a lot of runway. There are still a lot of high-margin businesses out there which Bezos will disrupt if he has the opportunity.
You know, speaking of Amazon, their plans for building a Rockefeller-style center in downtown Seattle, which I'm hoping includes an ice skating rink.
Oh, no, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, that's sort of what he alluded to.
Yeah.
But and now we have a big tower going in Seattle. You know, they just announced that big tower in Seattle. They're finally
going
to build that
that's
one.
Right. One of the tallest buildings in many years.
And then, as you bring up, speaking of Rockefeller Center, Rockefeller Center. Rockefeller Corporation building in Bellevue.
Rockefeller Group Development Corporation, story in the paper last week, has taken an option on a key corner in downtown Bellevue owned by the Sterling Realty Organization with plans for, I think, a total of 1.5 million square feet of office space in three buildings above a central podium, which would provide retail and office space. And, of course, Rockefeller Development is famous for Rockefeller Center, but also owns real estate in Washington, D.C., and in several other states. And it's significant that a big organization like that would pick Seattle out of all the alternatives where it could develop.
But how about pick Bellevue?
Pick Bellevue, I should say, which, as the Seattle Times story noted, has the region's lowest office vacancy rate, a city where three other office towers will be built this year, and I think a total of five residential buildings are expected to go into construction with 1,100 apartments. And at as the Times reported, a 24-hour city now, going all the time. You know what? We should not have for a long time, and we certainly should not now, think of Bellevue as just a bedroom community. Bellevue is doing just fine on its own.
And someday they'll even allow light rail through their downtown.
There we go. Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting, though, that they are locating in Bellevue.
Sure.
And here's Amazon is building these big towers. We have this other big tower going in. Richard Hager started the show today, and real estate. And he started by, and I said, you know, what's going on? People are still coming. People are still coming. He said, but he reminded me, they're coming. Those cranes aren't there because they're just there. It's demand.
Oh,
which
absolutely
means more and more people are coming, more and more people believing in this region.
We're hot. Yeah. Amazon is hot, has thousands of job openings posted on its website. We're hot in terms of medical, cancer research, Paul Allen's brain research. We're hot in terms of video games. We're hot in terms of entertainment. We have a thriving downtown in Seattle, a thriving core in Bellevue. John Talton likes to say that there are a lot of other places that would love to steal what we've got, and we have some things to worry about, including the opening of the Panama Canal in 2014, which will reduce perhaps container traffic and the blue-collar jobs that they support. But and this Boeing thing is a big caution flag. But put those things aside, the Seattle metropolitan area right now, I dare say that would be the envy of most other cities, say, in the top 15 in the United States. We've got a lot of things going for us right now. You worry a little bit. Just about the time you start believing your own press clippings is when you're most at risk.
Yeah. So, of course, the question remains, where's everybody going to live?
Where
are they going to afford to buy a house?
Sure.
And what the wage will be for those people who are trying to get their houses.
But remember that the younger folks who are coming prefer to live downtown, many of them without a car, and that's a good thing.
All right, sir. We'll see you again.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
I love doing this.
I love having you. Thank you for talking about the economy. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
That is the sound of a full mariachi band playing at a small party in Mexico. Listener Emily was in Mexico over the holidays. She could hear the music from their bungalow. After exploring for half a mile, they found the party. She says hearing the music takes her back to the sun-filled, relaxing beach life of vacation. Yeah, me too. What are you hearing? Relaxing or otherwise, record 30 seconds, send it to weekday@kuow.org, put sound of the day in the subject line. Bernardo Letts, our engineer. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Asade, with help from Andy Hurst, Alexander Garrettin, Danielle Anthony Goodwin. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
It's 10:59. Now that General John Allen has been cleared in the Petraeus email scandal, his NATO nomination will move forward. More on that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, performing two works by Israeli choreographers, February 9th at the Paramount Theater. More information at stgpresents.org.
Capitalism as a way of organizing an enterprise is fundamentally anti-democratic, and it's always been like that. So if you have a commitment to democracy that's more than verbal, you have a problem with capitalism. And you need to think about worker self-directed enterprise as the antidote, as the way finally to bring democracy to the workplace. And isn't it strange that it hasn't always been there?
Economist Richard Wolff on Democracy at Work, tonight at 8.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Boat Show, with more than 1,000 boats on display January 25th through February 3rd at CenturyLink Field and South Lake Union, with a shuttle between locations. Tickets online at Seattle Boat.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.